Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
So, I guess you have to get one last text in?
I do.
It's vital. You have to get the text in.
I might text during the podcast.
So
no one can see me.
Don't text during the podcast. That's not cool. Well, all right. So we're ready? Ready?
I guess so.
Ready? I get a head shake. I guess so. All right. Well, welcome to Real World Theology. I am your host, Fizz. I actually noticed that I forgot to say that last time. So if you're wondering who the guy was talking too much last time, that was me. This week, we are going to be discussing Joss Whedon's interpretation of Much Ado About Nothing, a film that came to theaters in June to actually much critical acclaim. And my guest this week, I don't want to, you know, jump too deeply into the river, but I have only had male guests so far, and I have overcorrected by having two amazing female guests with me this week. And so I'll introduce them now. One is Claire Austin, who is a dramaturg, which I have no idea what that means, but that's cool because I'm guessing if you are one, you understand.
Because you didn't watch Smash.
Yeah.
Obviously.
It was two episodes of Smash.
So did not watch Smash, much to my chagrin. Like I said, I'm already in too deep. She is a Shakespeare nerd, and a budding cultural preservation volunteer. So, welcome, Claire.
Thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. Our other guest is Laura Fissel, a former English teacher, currently a writer, a blogger, Shakespeare groupie, Whedonite, and her most challenging role to date, being married to me. So, I appreciate you being here.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I have two ladies who are not just overqualified to talk about this adaptation of a Shakespeare play, but they have backgrounds in theater, backgrounds in English, so they are definitely all about the Shakespeare. They happen to also be all about the Joss Whedon. So, I mean, I don't think I could have found better people to be on the show. Joss Whedon's Much Ado About Nothing, like I said, it came out last month. Some of the things that it kind of hit on were... the play in general hits on kind of some general stuff. It's has some Elizabethan thoughts on love, marriage, deception, maturity, lack of maturity, males being tricked all the time. One of the best things about this is that we're going to get to kind of look and see what Joss Whedon did and what he did different. You know, one of the best things about Shakespeare that I've enjoyed, in my novice in comparison, forays into Shakespeare, is noticing that when it's done differently, people, you know, bringing into a modern setting, a past setting, etc., and kind of seeing the parts that they want to really bring out, because there's so many themes, there's so many things that Shakespeare typically addresses. So we'll jump into that. So I just want to jump right in. Y'all can draw straws, y'all can paper, rock, scissors, but just kind of like, I mean, your initial thoughts, did you enjoy the movie? You know, what were some things that kind of stood out to you right away?
I really enjoyed the movie. I love Shakespeare. I love Much Ado in particular. I think it's not a very problematic play in some ways because it does have this very strong female lead in Beatrice. And so it's a very popular play with women and with everybody. So I enjoy the play in general, but I particularly enjoyed Joss's interpretation of it. I had a lot of fun. It was a very screwball comedy kind of feel, very classic in the way that it took from My Man Godfrey or It Happened One Night, one of those just banter comedies that's just so classic and fun to watch. So yeah, I had a really good time with it.
All right, Claire. So Laura, what did you think?
I really enjoyed it a lot. I think I was going to always enjoy it because it was Much Ado About Nothing, and that's my favorite Shakespearean play of all time. So that definitely had it going for it. But also, I felt like I was watching a bunch of artists slash creatives just having a really incredible time, and that to meant a lot to me as an artist, watching people do what they love and do it well and, you know, offer that for other people. And also, I really liked how simple it was with the black and white. There wasn't a lot to distract from the story and the language. And so I liked his interpretation, too. So it had a lot going for it in terms of what I love to see. So,
well, on my Facebook page, for all those people who follow me, this was one of the first movies of the year that I would consider like an A film. I mean, like, I know it's not Joss Whedon writing something original necessarily, I guess, depending on your artistic interpretation. But Joss talked about how he really enjoyed not having to start from scratch, you know, being the rewriter or like the kind of, he kind of molded it to his vision as opposed to having to start from scratch. And I thought that really showed, you know, he actually said in some interviews that he thought he was doing something completely different from Avengers. But then he ended up basically doing something that's very similar because it's all character driven. It's very, you know, what does it matter if you have people punching or fighting if you don't care about the people? And so I had to do some research because, like I said, I didn't want to get totally outclassed on this show. So some of my my favorite things that I found out were that, and I think this is part of the advertising, that, you know, Joss Whedon, he's kind of fairly famous now. Some of us Whedonites were pretty familiar with him before, but he just made Avengers, big splash, you know, hot thing in Hollywood right now. Avengers making $1.5 billion, and then he's forced to take a vacation. So on his vacation, in 12 days, he makes another amazing film. So, I mean, like, if you didn't have respect for Joss Whedon before, I think the fact that, like, what he does in his spare time is better than most people try to do in their entire lives. And I don't want to fawn over it too much, but I think that's pretty incredible. And I think it's also incredible when we see a director or a storyteller who can go from, you know, large action to, you know, interpreting Shakespeare in black and white. I just don't think there's a lot of people, it's a lot of storytellers who can do that. My other favorite fact, and this is something Laura and I were actually talking about before the show, is that the fact the title in and of itself, Much Ado About Nothing, is like the most pun of all puns ever punned. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, based on my internet research, which is totally factual.
Which does not lie.
Which does not lie. It talks about how the word nothing was slang for lady parts. So it is much ado about nothing. Nothing is also a homophone for noting. And in Elizabethan times, noting was slang for sex. So much ado about noting. There was also lots of examples of noting and other types of things like that in the play where you have noting as in eavesdropping. You were, you know, noting something was happening, lots of eavesdropping. Noting as in physical notes between characters that we saw towards the end with Benedict and Beatrice. Oh, noticing, which thankfully some of our characters could actually do, such as the friar, Beatrice, and Benedict, when things were going crazy and everyone was being fooled and lied to. Some actually were noting what was actually happening. One of the things that we'll get to in a second about something that Joss did or didn't do that other people have done is that in the play, we're not supposed to see, from what I understand, Baraccio and Margaret actually doing the deed that causes trouble in the middle of the film. So the thing that the play entirely hinges on is something that the audience never sees. So it's, you know, nothing. And so I thought that was cool too. So I love puns and I want to talk about that. I wanted y'all to be really impressed with how much research I've done and how smart I am.
Done.
So now I don't have to say anything for the rest of the podcast. So, the first thing we really want to move into is, Joss's interpretation. These are the things that I've wanted to talk to y'all about, and I've bit my tongue. I have run. I have closed my ears because I do not want to know. I didn't want to know until right now. So, Claire, just tell me, like, what Joss did in his interpretation of this film that really, like, set a different tone or just a different, it almost made it his own, you know?
Well, he did a few things that I noticed like I said, it has a very 1930s screwball comedy feel, with how the characters interact with each other. It's got a lot of alcohol, which is a standard in especially Prohibition era filmmaking, with people really wanting to get out of their surroundings and totally escape. It's got that escapist feel. Joss made a couple of choices that I noticed. He turned Conrad, one of Don John's henchmen, into a woman. And at first, I was a little bit confused about this, although it does make Conrad's interactions with Don John sexier. I wasn't sure about what it did for the story until I read an interview with Joss Whedon where he said it was nice to have another girl in the play, sure, but he also wanted to show the only stable relationship being between villains, which I thought was really interesting. And the other interesting thing about this is that in the play, it's alluded to that Beatrice and Benedict have this past, but you don't really know quite what it is. And because this is a movie, you get to see a little bit more of what it could have been, according to Joss Whedon. So you kind of see people who have an obvious physical connection, who have a physical history, who are trying very hard to hide the fact that they're also emotionally invested in each other as well.
Now, when you saw that, did that kind of do something for you when you're rooting for Beatrice and Benedict?
I think it makes their relationship a lot more significant because if you interpret the play from the perspective that they are completely over each other and they're kind of neutral about each other, then their whole love is based on a lie, mm-hmm. and it's based on this manipulation. But in this play, the lie is really the catalyst for something that had really been churning for a while to explode into true love and mixed metaphors and all that good stuff.
I think the play really is very specific about showing there is a past to you. I mean, mm-hmm. in the opening scene, Beatrice says, "You always end with a jade's trick. I know you of old." So she has had this history with them. And then there were a couple of times, one in particular I'm thinking about, at the party, the masquerade, Benedict is just going off about Beatrice, and at some point he stops and says to Don Pedro, don't even bring her up. And then Don Pedro had said nothing about mm-hmm. her, and so he already is just talking about her because she's on his mind. So I think there are a lot of things in the play that allude to a past that was already there. And I totally agree, like, if it wasn't for that, then what is their love based on? And actually, something I was just thinking about when you were talking about that opening scene in Joss's version is that, you know, this we've already established that there's a lot of sex in this play, and there are a lot of puns on that kind of stuff that happens between men and women. And there's a lot to talk about in this play and in this movie about love relationships and how that's defined. But it is interesting to me that in Joss's version, he shows that Beatrice and Benedict have already done the physical thing. And the whole rest of the play is about them, like, learning each other through words and not, you know, not ever touching each other until, like, you know, close to the end. So it's not physical as much as it is about, like, revealing each other's soul to each other, you know, and trying to be brave enough to be open and exposed to another person. So I think that's interesting that, you know, that kind of was already out of the equation. Like, they already did the sex thing, and it did nothing for their relationship, so now they're having to learn each other in a whole other way. So, kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. Which in and of itself kind of goes against most of the romantic comedies we usually get to see nowadays, because that's one of my pet peeves about watching romantic comedies. Like, most storytellers can only tell us that they like each other when the scene cuts to them waking up together, like, the next day. And not that that's impossible to happen, but, like, it's almost cliche now to the point where I was like, that doesn't really work most of the time, but, like, that's our standard. And so this one we see where it actually went awry. And so I did also think it was a good addition. It really, like I said, I was really rooting for them because of it. I was like, oh man, make it work. So, what else kind of stood out?
Something that, you mentioned that, Much Ado About Nothing could be, you know, heard probably with the accent that most people performed Shakespeare in back in the day, it would have sounded like Much Ado About Nothing. And so that whole concept of, overhearing and observing and then acting on your interpretation of what you have observed. I was thinking about that, and there's one scene that really struck me after the wedding has totally gone awry, and you see this photographer going around throughout the whole thing taking pictures, and she turns to the camera and she takes a picture almost of the audience. Like, she takes a picture of us. And it just kind of made me think about social media and just kind of like, you know, just pictures and Facebook and tweets and that kind of stuff, and how a lot of that is just observing on the outside and treating it like truth and making judgments based on that. So I thought that was really interesting that he, you know, he did have people with cell phones and he had, you know, a photographer with a fancy camera. And so just kind of, it just made me think more about that as a part of our culture, which is one of the things I love about this play, is it's totally timeless. I mean, Shakespeare is in general, but yeah, I just feel like it, you can put it in almost any setting and it has something to say about our culture. So,
well, they do talk about in some interviews with Joss that he kind of acknowledges that this is the background for a number of, like I said, romantic comedy, arguing couples that we want to see get together because they're arguing, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I would definitely say that it's timeless too, which is why I hesitate to almost tackle any of this at all, because it's not just that we're talking about a film that came out a month ago. It's like the entire history of this play that is still performed,
and done by Joss. I mean,
yeah,
I immediately thought of Malcolm and Inara from Firefly. I mean, they are totally Beatrice and Benedict. Just bickering all the time, not really too proud to let each other in, too proud to be the first person to say, this is how I really feel, you know, and almost coming to that edge and then, you know, stepping away. So he definitely has done this kind of relationship before.
Was there anything else that really stood out to you about the way that Joss did it, or that his interpretation kind of, any quirky things? I see the wheels churning. Well, I'll say this: we've watched a couple interpretations of it these past couple weeks to kind of prep for this, so we weren't just going in cold, being like, "This is the only interpretation." And I noticed that most of the things that I saw actually, like, almost stopped the play for music. And while I like the music in this version, I felt like it was more of a backdrop as opposed to stopping the entire play and saying, everyone listen to this thing, you know, because I almost didn't catch the Sign of More song at all. Mm-hmm. And actually I missed it,
right.
Because I was more watching what was going on during the party and stuff like that. And it was actually Laura who pointed it out to me later. She was like, oh, it was there. That's what they were singing. I mean, it was a really nice version, but I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention to the lyrics. And when I'm looking at other versions, like the lyrics, especially in like that Sign of More section, I think are very key to the entire play. I mean, did y'all feel that like that almost made too light of it, or incorporate it in such a way that just didn't seem corny?
I think it made it a more subversive element to the play, or to the film rather. I think that Joss's Much Ado has darkness, but it's a very subtle, subversive thing. You see these imperfect people, and you see how dangerous their imperfections are. But it's such a pretty setting, and they're having a party, and they're drinking a lot and having a lot of fun. So it's kind of on the undercurrent. And like you, I kind of miss the song being more prominent, because I think it's one of the key critical messages and conflicts of the play. But I think that one of the reasons for that could be that it's more of a pervasive message that's subliminal.
I don't necessarily have anything to say about the song, but I do have one other thing I loved about his version.
Okay.
I love the Kenneth Branagh version of Much Ado. I think it still is my favorite version of the play, almost because I want to say I don't consider this version Much Ado, just Much Ado. I don't know, it's Whedon's Much Ado, which to me means something more than just an interpretation of Shakespeare. But I really don't like Michael Keaton's Dogberry in Kenneth Branagh's version. And I was a little worried about Nathan Fillion because I'm pretty sure I read that he'd never done Shakespeare before, like not professionally, not in front of an audience. And I was a little worried about it, but he did a fantastic job. And, I mean, he had me just like laughing out loud through the movie. And I thought it made him a very endearing character because he was trying so hard all the time to get it right, and he was getting everything wrong, exactly wrong. And but he just was he was just an endearing fool instead of just a fool, which to me seems important when you've got like all these rich people who are partying, and then you have kind of this lower class that's on the fringes. You've got like, you know, I guess servants. I guess they're just servants. And then you have like the lowly watchman. And so it just seemed important to me that he is bumbling, but he isn't doing it on purpose. And everybody else are making mistakes, and they can change those things. But all the rich people are bumbling too through the situations that are going on there. So I really liked that. And I just thought, the way that he, just these really little subtle things that he did with the lawman were great. I mean, I was just cracking up when they locked their keys in the car at the very end. It was just such a great touch. So anyway, I really liked his Dogberry. I think he's probably my favorite Dogberry that I've seen so far.
Well, I mean, it would be classic Whedon to like have characters that you love and or you love to hate. And or you sympathize with, like, there's no wasted characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that helps really move the story into a place where it can be identified with. You get that subtle dark humor.
That's a great way to say it. No wasted characters, because he really nuanced some characters that I felt were really two dimensional in the play. Like Baratheon, he just made so much more sense. His motivations made so much more sense in Joss's version. Because he clearly was in love with Hero from Joss's perspective. And so everything he did was to get at Claudio because Hero loved him, or to see if he could get Claudio back, maybe, or Hero for himself. Margaret's motivations made so much more sense because she seemed to be in love with Baratheon and would do whatever he asked her to do. And then at the end, when Baratheon confesses what he's done, it's because he's heartbroken that his actions led to Hera's supposed death. So, yeah, it just seemed like, before I kind of felt like, oh, why is he making mischief? Why is he confessing now to his mischief? But this just was so much more nuanced. And it just made me feel like all of these people are people with motivations and backstory. And he did that, I think, with Conrad, having a relationship with Don John, and
both of you touched on something that I noticed too, which is that the characters themselves had these sort of Whedon-esque nuances to them, and Beatrice, for instance, to me is such a Whedon character, and she's stuck in this universe where she can't be a vampire slayer, she can't defend her cousin, but, you know, if she were in Firefly, or if she were in any of Joss's other things, that she'd be super powerful.
Because you're defining a very Whedon-esque character as a very powerful female lead.
Well, that's something that's been that's a theme in Whedon's work.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also something to the no wasted characters idea that he does really well too.
Mm-hmm. And I completely agree with that. I just wanted There's probably some people out there who started watching Joss Whedon kind of joints with the Avengers, and they might not be familiar with some of the older stuff. And he does have a history, and it's actually well documented, especially in the interviews leading up to Much Ado's release and after, I guess, about like, hey, you love strong women characters, you want to keep pushing this archetype of, you know, the strong female doesn't need a man, can, you know, equality kind of stuff. So that's definitely one of the things that he's known for, and I think Beatrice does fit that mold. To the point where I think even Laura pointed out earlier, if we examine, you know, Joss's own history of his body of work, we see strong female characters and or relationships that mirror things that we see in Much Ado. So, but this is real world theology, and we had kind of had a hit on some subtle themes. And we typically, one of the things I really don't like to do is try to make everything about Jesus. Because I don't think everything necessarily is about Jesus. Like, no, when they wrote some of these plays, they weren't like, how is this all a metaphor for Jesus? Now, I think some things are like that. I think actually our last episode when we talked about Superman, Superman's a lot like, you know, that's obviously a metaphor for Jesus. But in this one, when I'm doing some of the research, I'm doing, you know, history, I'm noticing that people are like, oh, the way that Christians can really jump on with this film is because hero is this wonderful metaphor for Christ. And I'm kind of looking at it and I'm like, okay, I kind of get it. You know, she died, she was resurrected, and she brings people into, you know, joyful bliss. And then you have like the Don John is the Satan character trying to, you know, who's ultimately responsible for the death, but his plans are foiled with the resurrection. And I don't buy it. I think it's kind of silly. I think it's, you know, one of those stretching moments. And I mean, is this something that has kind of crossed either of y'all's paths?
I don't think certain aspects of it are much of a stretch. I think the imagery of hero in the movie supports kind of that interpretation that if not Jesus, some kind of angelic savior figure. She's in white, she's got this cross ring that she always wears, and she is someone who voluntarily in this movie takes on shame that isn't hers to bear. So I think that you could look at it from that angle, but I think that as a Christian, I can look at some of the other aspects and kind of look at the spirituality that of those things, like marriage, for instance. Mm-hmm. That's a deeply spiritual thing for a Christian. And this play has a lot to say about marriage, and Whedon's version has a lot to say about marriage, and some of it's different from the Judeo-Christian worldview. And so I think those things are equally valid ways of exploring the theology of the film.
I actually was really struggling with hero as a Christ figure in just kind of that whole concept. But I was thinking this afternoon about just how love is defined in the play by the characters and by the playwright and by Whedon and how he directs. And actually, I kind of was writing, I wrote down some things that I thought might be each character's definition of what love is, or part of that definition. So for Claudio, I have love is a badge of honor, or love is faithful, i.e. sexually faithful. Benedict, love transforms you because he's afraid of being transformed. In fact, he even says, you know, I won't be so converted until love transforms me into an oyster. And then Beatrice, love proves its worth by action, like when she says, use your hand by some other thing than swearing, you know, than swearing by it. Her hand or love, I can't remember that line. Leonardo, the father, might say love is obedient. Don Pedro, maybe love can be manipulated. He says, you know, if they're able to get Beatrice and Benedict to fall in love with each other, then they are the only love gods. Mm-hmm. So, and then I really didn't want to, but I turned to the 1 Corinthians love verse, and I kind of saw how the Bible was defining love. And I won't read that out loud, but I did realize that the only person who was loving in that way was Hero. Because it says that love keeps no record of wrong. She didn't hold anything against Claudia, which has always bothered me. But if we're talking about her in terms of, you know, like a Christ figure, she didn't hold anything against him. She was always faithful to him. She was patient with him. She's kind. She wasn't self-seeking because she wasn't self-protecting because he had dishonored her. Instead, she was forgiving. She trusts him. She hopes in the best parts of those around her, particularly Claudio. So she's faithful to Claudio and also to what her father tells her to do. That, I mean, if you're thinking of love outside of love of Claudio, because earlier in the play, Leonardo finds out through hearsay, another, you know, eavesdropping thing, that the prince is going to be wooing Hero, and then he tells Hero, if the prince woos you, you have to say yes. And she does say yes. She just doesn't know that he's wooing on behalf of Claudia. So, yeah, I've never really liked... her character seems kind of shallow and one-dimensional, and but she does... She is the only person in this play who loves in a way that is actually transforming. So I found that very interesting. And, you know, like you said, she dies, quote-unquote, for something that is not a shame, that is not hers to bear, and then she comes back. So her name is Hero. So, you know. But anyway, I reluctantly discovered that this afternoon, that I, you know, that maybe I was wrong about how I was viewing her in terms of that imagery.
So maybe not as the best direct Christ metaphor, but as like an incarnation of love as we would understand it in the Christian tradition. She, and then love being what God is, you know, she would be a representation of that kind of indirectly.
Yeah. Well, perfect love, you know,
yeah, perfect
a love,
love
that, you know, accepts you, that forgives you, even though you don't deserve it. Claudio definitely does not deserve it.
Frustrates everyone at the end because we all seek justice to some degree and we want to see Claudio have to pay for it more than, well, and that's something I was going to get to later, but, you know, we do see Claudio willing to, you know, repent of his, you know, inactions or misactions. But I think in our time and our culture, we don't understand like how much he's actually giving up or, you know, kind of agreeing to as a punishment. I use quote marks, you know, because to us, I think in our culture, we don't see what he did. We're like, oh, did you just marry this other good looking girl instead? Okay. Well, I know you don't see her, but surely, you know, you've seen everyone else at this party. And if you don't like her, we've got a lot of alcohol, as we've seen throughout the film. So so there is that. But yeah, I totally do understand the need to not like Hero, because we want to see, like I said, we want to see that picture of justice, but we actually get a picture of grace instead.
Mm-hmm.
So if we expand on that, and I think Claire especially, you already started kind of moving into, I think, some of the better things that we can really dive into, because it's not something that you can just kind of watch the movie, write a couple sentences down, and kind of be like, let me wash my hands of like why Christians would want to see this. Like, it's talking about love, and it's making, I think, some pretty bold accusations of love. It's making some assumptions about love. And so, I mean, where do you see this play? Like, there's gotta be a reason it's hung on so long. You know, if it was a crappy play, people have been like, whatever, but obviously it's saying something to us. So, I mean, like, where did you see it going with like the marriage, love, like, talk so I don't have to.
Okay. I don't have a lot of great observations on how good marriage is or how good it can be from this play. Because I think on the whole, it's a pretty negative interpretation of marriage. I was trying to find examples of where they say nice things about marriage, and they don't. There are like 2.5 marriages in this play, and they're just not great. And even at the end where Benedict says to Don Pedro, oh, you're sad, get you a wife. That's kind of the only switch in there for me as to encouraging somebody to get married, because it's a good thing. It's generally not portrayed as a happy thing because men cheat and women cheat. Like, they talk about it all the time. And for Benedict, initially they talk about marriage being a yoke, and that's a metaphor that comes up repeatedly in the play, where he doesn't want to be restrained by this yoke, and then he does, but it's always a yoke. And for Beatrice, it's a curse.
Mm-hmm.
And she thanks God that she's single, and she's going to lead apes into hell. And and they do eventually find out they love each other, and love is the thing that makes marriage bearable, I guess, in this play. But it can also be orchestrated really artificially, and you can make or break a marriage pretty quickly in this play.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when I watched the film, the play, I came away with it having the words of Dr. Tim Keller, pastor of Redeemer in New York City, some words he said in his like marriage series, and he's talking about love. And he says, love is an action first. You know, he goes on to say, if you love people, you eventually begin to like them. The more you love them, the more you give yourself, the more you find your heart tied up to them, and kind of points out that, and when your heart gets tied up to them, then you have that whole concept of where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And, you know, because he's talking about people who fall out of like with each other. And when I go back to the scene that we talked about at the beginning, when we see that flashback of Beatrice and Benedict, like, in bed together, kind of maybe going their separate ways, maybe falling out of like with each other, but then they stop trying, you know? But once they're kind of convinced, they start actually moving in each other's directions. They start acting loving to one another, and that eventually makes them realize how much they like the other person. And that, to me, I thought, is kind of crazy. I mean, because that's not the way I think, you know, like I said, our culture would probably see it. You know, you either like someone or you don't. It's either obvious because you're nice to each other. You know, there's no way to love someone without feeling loving to them. So, I mean, when you talk about the whole concept of them shifting and being angry at each other, that's kind of, like I said, that's the first thing that popped in my mind.
It's interesting to me that, particularly in one of my favorite parts of the whole play, Benedict's monologue, when he's talking about Claudio being in love and how annoyed he is and how he'll never be turned husband, etc., etc. He talks about love and falling in love as basically emasculating. He says that Claudio only used to like the sound of the drum and the fife, but now he likes to hear the tabor and the pipe. And, you know, what'd he say? He would walk a good distance to see like a good battle, but now he just wants to talk about love, and his words are a fantastical banquet. But what Benedict discovers by the end is that it is actually the opposite of that. Love is a battle, and he battles with Beatrice. I mean, it really, the wit is so quick in the play that it feels like a sword fight. You know, they're always parrying each other's words and, you know, giving another blow. And and actually Benedict finds at the end that, like what you said, like acting on your love. And she said, you show me that you love me, kill Claudio. And he decides that he's actually got to take up a real sword and do something really difficult in the name of love. So what he was, his concept of love, wherever he got that from, is totally different from the reality, which is that it is probably the hardest fight you have to fight, and it's going to take real sacrifice. And he finally comes to that at the end. I mean, when he's really angry at Beatrice after the masquerade, he says to Don Pedro, you know, give me any task and I will go, you know, I'll go pluck a hair from the great Cham's beard, or, you know, anything for you. And then we see him saying, you know, I'll do anything for you, Beatrice, you know, like, even though I don't agree with this whole Claudio being your, you know, your enemy, then I'll do what you ask me to do. So, but yeah, it's interesting that he discovered it to be the opposite of what he thought it was going to be.
And it reminds me a lot of my marriage, because I don't know how many times Laura has asked me to kill a man to prove my love.
Countless
times. To pluck a hair from some random thing in a state far away. So I would just go away for a couple of days. Any other thoughts on love in general in this? I mean, like, did you see, what does Much Ado tell us about love? Is it real?
Love is real, and it makes you do stupid things. I think that the love between Beatrice and Benedict is very real, and I think that there's every indication that they would have a very happy marriage where they probably fight all the time. Mm-hmm. I think the love that Hero has for Claudio is real. I think the love that Claudio has for Hero at the beginning is very fragile. And it's based on things that can just evaporate. And it's almost like Hero is reduced to her virginity, and that's the thing that makes or breaks this marriage for him. Mm-hmm. But I think going through that harrowing, transforming experience, hopefully he's on a good path to maybe developing actual love for her in the future. But I think throughout the whole film, they did a great job of showing how much of a jerk Claudio is, both mm-hmm. Joss Whedon and Frank Kranz. I feel like...
And whiny.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like you can play Claudio as stupid, or you can play him as somebody who is just not a very good person. And I don't think this Claudio is a very good person.
Well, what does that kind of... where does that... That kind of leads us down to... I hate to call it gender roles, because it's such a broad... topic, idea, but especially when we take into account Joss Whedon and his affinity to have strong female leads and not really let the guys have all the best things. Does this do him justice? Do we see places where he emasculates men on purpose?
Yes, but I think it's things that are totally justified by the play. You have just the fun element of getting to dress men in stupid costumes. Like, who doesn't want to see Clark Gregg, like, with that, like, mask with the streamers and stuff? Everybody needs that. But I think it's things that are justified by the script. I thought it was really good to have Benedict shave. I think that is so good, so justified, to show the steps that he will take to impress this lady. And it also harkens back to Beatrice's speech about how she's not going to marry a kid with no beard, and she's not going to marry an old man. Mm-hmm. And in Benedict, we have somebody who can do all the macho stuff. He's been to the wars, he can grow a beard, but he...
can run up and down steps many, yes. many times.
Lots of lunges there. And he deliberately shaves. He deliberately becomes the man who will listen to her and who will do what she says.
Well, I assume you both picked up on the fact that we're having like a... or at the beginning of the film, they're having a very almost macho conversation in a little girl's room.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like just pointing out kind of like the silliness of their like machismo.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that. You know, like I said, that was one of the interpretation things that I thought really kind of hit home, because I, you know, watching other plays, I saw that same scene and it just kind of seemed like, you know, bravado banter kind of between two characters. But then and there, it just kind of said, everyone realizes how silly this conversation.
Let's put this in perspective.
Yeah. Do you think that the play itself, not necessarily what Joss did with it, but do you think the play itself kind of gave archetypes for, like, what an ideal woman would be, or maybe an ideal man. I mean, because we see, like, Hero as, like, the perfect little daughter, but then we see Beatrice, who's the kind of pave her own way. You know, do you feel, as ladies, like, that one of those stuck out as, like, something that should be emulated, or just too random of a question?
I really like Beatrice and Benedict's relationship because they actually are equal partners. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can give as good as they get. And so it almost feels like there is no gender role in that relationship necessarily, except for the one imposed on Beatrice by the play standards when she can't go and seek revenge against Claudio herself. So I feel like that is actually a pretty equal relationship. And now I forget what the question was.
Well, I mean, like, is it, like I said, do you feel, like, as women, like...
Oh, that there's something to emulate. I like that Beatrice can hold her own, but she still wants love. She still wants somebody to defend her, to listen to her when she's... I mean, she's weeping and weeping over what's happened to her cousin. And actually, I feel like that scene, her famous, oh, that I were a man speech, that whole section actually gives us the most accurate glimpse, I think, into what a marriage will look like between Beatrice and Benedict. Because she's crying, they've been fighting this whole time, he could just walk away, but he actually wades into that and asks her about what she's feeling and why is she crying. And, so I think that shows something about his willingness to, I mean, if we're going to talk stereotypical gender roles, I mean, I feel like men are supposed to be uncomfortable around crying, right? And they're supposed to kind of be like, suck it up. But he wants to know what's wrong with her. And then there are other stereotypes in our culture, like about how women manipulate their men and make them do what they want to. And that, you know, men are too weak to stand up to what their women want. But when Beatrice says, kill Claudio, he says, not for the wide world. And then he actually asks her to really think about that request. So he doesn't just brush off her request, but he, again, wades into that and says, are you sure this is what you think? And then he trusts her when she says, yes, as surely as I have a thought or a soul, he is my enemy. And so he says, okay, then. Which is not something Claudio did when Hero says, I didn't have sex with anybody last night. And he says, I don't believe you, basically. You know, instead he trusts what Beatrice is feeling. So, I don't know. I think it actually breaks apart a lot of stereotypes and shows a really equal, authentic relationship that I certainly... I mean, I feel like those are things that are reminiscent of my own marriage or things that I tried to achieve in my own marriage, is real communication, really listening to the person, trusting that they, you know.
I'm taking notes.
Really investigating what they're feeling and not discounting it, but also asking them to think about it. I mean, so I think their relationship is actually a pretty strong relationship that they've had to really fight for. And it shows that they're not perfect and they're not going to continue to be perfect because they almost got themselves out of it at the end. If it weren't for the love sonnets that they have been toiling over through the last half of the play that are revealed at the end, reveal how they really feel at the end. You know, there's a lot of apprehension about being exposed in love to somebody and, giving up your pride, and I think both of them really struggle with that. I mean, they really have the same faults. So, I don't know. I just see a lot of equality in that relationship and a lot of authenticity, which is, I mean, again, really remarkable because I feel like that's how relationships, good relationships often are in our culture. I mean, it's not really any different. Maybe that was progressive for that time. I mean, I don't imagine a lot of Elizabethan marriages being that equal. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting play in that respect. And Beatrice is an interesting role model and figure in that respect. I feel like Much Ado, the environment of Much Ado is a man's world. when Hero is slandered, there is not a woman in a position of authority who can stand up for her. She has no mother. And I think in a sense, because there are so few women with a real voice in this play, like, you can go back and forth on how one or two dimensional Hero is. But Beatrice really sticks out. She's someone who is confined in this ridiculous structure, but she has found ways to be content with her situation, whether she's single or whether she's in a relationship with somebody, and she's found ways to get what she wants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she does not accept. She does exactly what Leonardo told Hero to do. She does the opposite, because he said, if the prince solicits you, you marry him. And then he asks Beatrice, will you marry me? Which is such an interesting part to me of the play, just that the prince asks Beatrice to marry him, and she will not have him. That seems kind of like a crazy thing, that she has the power to say no. And I think the way she conducts herself is where she's gotten her power, because people kind of, depending on your interpretation, I guess, but in most of the plays or movies I've seen, most people just kind of laugh her off. Like, oh, she's just funny. That's just the way she is. Almost not taking her seriously. But it's that demeanor that has given her the power to say, because she doesn't say, no, you're not the man for me. She just jokes with him and it's all okay, you know? But there is somebody who takes her very seriously, and that's Benedict, you know? So, I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting. That's kind of where she gets her power, is she is manipulating a lot of things.
Well, as a dude, I noticed that something you did hit on was the ability for kind of deception in all those relationships. And I noticed as a man, it was hard to watch this and not be really let down in almost every aspect by almost every male character in this, because it's like, even someone who at the end of the play you can kind of get with, like Benedict, you know, for finally coming through and realizing the error of his, you know, his whole worldview. Everyone else in this play, every other man in this play, has been deceived or tricked or is too immature to understand what's going on. And if it wasn't the fact that my gender kind of looks silly most of this play, one of my favorite kind of lines was like when Dogberry kind of reveals what had happened at the end, and I don't remember who says it, but he says, like, what your wisdoms could not discover, these shallow fools have brought to light. You know, like, yep. Like, how could you be deceived by something that was, you know,
so obvious,
or, you know, and there's a come on moment that I'll get, you know, when we get to that part because of that, but it was nice and refreshing to see the man that Benedict becomes, mm-hmm. you know, serving, caring, having to convince his own pride that he wants to or does not want to do things. But I thought it was kind of tongue-in-cheek, making men look pretty silly, mm-hmm. Which may or may not be deserved. I'll leave that for a different panel.
Well, I think everybody looked silly. I don't know. I mean, I think Beatrice looked silly. She directly contradicts herself many, many times when she's trying to seem like she doesn't need a man. But everything she does is about, you know, trying to one-up Benedict or make sure he sees that she's there, you know. So I think everyone looks silly. And I love Benedict as a character. I mean, he's so real to me. He doesn't even really believe himself, because he's constantly arguing with himself about what he would or would not do.
No one else on screen, just him.
Just him talking to himself constantly.
Just like I do when I jog up and downstairs. How do I feel about love and being married?
I just love so many of his lines. It kind of makes me want to talk about some things that I was thinking about, the topic of maturity. And that, you know, you're saying he and Claudia are exchanging words in the little girl's room, which is such a great setting. They even, in Joss's version, they even wrestle like little kids in the room, and then only a couple of scenes, you know, like an act later, he's slapping him across the face and challenging him to a real fight. So there's a lot of growing up, I think, that happens in this play between a lot of characters. Mm-hmm. Probably not Claudio as much as I would like, but maybe we don't see enough of the post-trauma Claudio to be able to see that. But I don't know. To me, the reason why people do mature in this play is such a biblical concept of relationships, because they're all bumbling, they're all fools, they're all messed up, they're all flawed, but it's in rubbing up against each other that they see those flaws. Maybe not, you know, you can argue, I guess, how intentional that is or not, but I think Benedict and Beatrice are directly involved in revealing some things about their nature that they change at the end. I don't know. I just feel like it just kind of reminds me of the whole, like, iron sharpening iron, that you don't grow up on your own. Like, you are shown the areas of weakness by looking into the mirror of man, like, across from you, you know? And with their help, you change who you were and become something different. I'm having a hard time thinking of anybody else who does this but Benedict and Beatrice. I mean, maybe Hero with Claudio a little bit? I don't know. Does that ring true to anybody else? Kind of iron sharpening iron, people revealing their weaknesses to each other and growing?
Yeah, I think it's mainly Beatrice and Benedict. I think that, especially in the Whedon version, a lot of attention is on Hero's development post-sequestering, kind of. But yeah, the shocking thing about, like, the old dudes in this play is that they're the people with the least insight. The people who you would think, oh, Leonardo's going to trust his daughter. He knows her. Mm-hmm. Nope. He's getting ready to kill her.
Yeah.
He'd rather she was dead. Don Pedro, you'd think, like, here's this person in authority. He's going to be an impartial figure. But no.
Let's not investigate that further.
No. Yeah, it's really hard, in some cases, to see the lack of development and lack of kind of character maturation in some of these characters. Mm-hmm. But for all that you don't get, you have Beatrice and Benedict and how far their characters come.
I mean, to some degree, Benedict's friends know how ridiculous he is, and Beatrice's friends know how ridiculous she is about love, and they know enough about them to say, we think we can show them that they really are in love with this person. And then at the end, when Benedict and Beatrice are about to say, oh, I don't love you any more than reason, you know, and they're about to part ways, their friends are the ones who say, look, here's your own hand against you. We know that you love each other. So there are some moments like that. And even Benedict, you know, by challenging Claudio, shows him, he says to him and Don Pedro, you have between killed a very sweet lady. So he's saying, you have done something wrong. So there are a few instances where friends know each other and are stepping up to say, that's not who you really are. Come on, you know? So I kind of like that in terms of needing relationships, needing other people in your life. But yeah, it is sad to see that there really aren't any wise, you know, I mean, I looked up this verse in Ephesians about being a body and as the church, and about, like, helping each other grow and not being babes anymore, but maturing in the word. And it mentions, you know, having like apostles and prophets and evangelists put over you to help you grow in the word. There doesn't seem to really be any mature, wiser kind of pastors or shepherds or whatever in this story who can do that.
Well, I've been thinking, as we were talking for a few minutes, about the ridiculously minor character that is the friar.
Mm-hmm.
But, and yet, he advises that that hero pretend to die and everything, because it could be argued that he knows that public opinion's gonna pass, and the truth will come to light, maybe. And, but just that this looks like the end of her world, but it's not really the end of her world, and we just need to let things die down. And I think that is very wise, but he's such a minor, minor character that we don't get to see anything else of him.
Yeah, that's true, but if it wasn't for his plan, then Leonardo would have done harm to his daughter, and, you know, the truth wouldn't have been sought out. And
maybe that's extreme he had to go to, because other than that, it seems kind of like a wacky, wacky plan, you know?
It does.
He's like, okay, stick with me here. What we're going to do, you know, ..
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, have you been into
the
sacramental wine friar, you know?
Shakespeare just loves to have these friars who suggest that people fake their own deaths.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Luckily, this time, with slightly better outcome than Romeo and Juliet.
That's what makes this a comedy.
Exactly. One of the articles you linked was about a comparison between Baz Luhrmann's Great Gatsby and this version of Much Ado, which I thought was such a strange comparison, because Great Gatsby is a tragedy through and through. And so, I mean, just the whole, what you're aiming for with the film is going to be totally different. I mean, Romeo and Juliet is also a tragedy, but it's a closer comparison. And like Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet is a closer comparison to like what he was trying to do with Shakespeare versus what Whedon did with Shakespeare. I think that's an interesting thing. But yeah, I mean, it's a comedy. So, I mean, some things, like with The Wedding, like you were saying, he took hero's sin, quote unquote, so seriously. Well, there's really not much more you can do. That's in the text. You have to have that scene because so much else hinges on it. So you can't really interpret that any other way.
And for something that's so subtly, like, kind of humorous through the entire film, like, I'm like, how is the scene so uncomfortable?
Oh, yeah.
You know?
There are a couple of those really uncomfortable.
But it still works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're kind of getting towards the end of our time, but I wanted to, like, is there anything else that y'all wanted to hit on before we kind of move on to the wrap-up? Everyone check their notes? Checking.
I don't know if you have things you didn't get to say about deception, about the theme of deception.
Okay.
I kind of felt like...
I may have some things about deception.
Oh, good.
Just kidding.
You want to go first?
I have deceived you.
Fell for it. I think it's a valid question to ask. How is everyone so easily duped? You know, it just seems like no one is really thinking beyond the surface. And so I thought about that a lot and just kind of was wondering, is it just kind of a device that the playwright uses to get people into scrapes and, you know, have there to be a plot? But I think that it is a commentary on the way that humans perceive what happens around them. Because the more I thought about the answer to that question, the more I realized that everyone was acting in a way that was protecting, I think, if we want to talk in terms of idols in your life, I mean, idols is being the chief sin, that you are putting all your weight on something in your life, and that's what you're worshiping. I mean, there are a lot of different idols in this play for different people. I think Benedict and Beatrice both idolize their pride. They fear shame, but I think they also fear rejection because they're unwilling to expose themselves to say, I do have feelings for you. In fact, Benedict, you know, if we want to talk about pursuing, Benedict is the first person who says, I love you. He says, I do love you more than anything else in the world. It's not that strange. And she doesn't confess her love until he confesses his. So I think that a lot of what they do is because they're protecting that idol of pride or, you know, acceptance. They're afraid of rejection or whatever. And then, of course, for Leonardo and Pedro and Claudio, it seems to be their honor is what is most important to them, because Leonardo reacts violently to Hero's supposed shame because that's his only child. It's his heir, and now she's dishonored the house or whatever. Claudio doesn't want to marry a woman who, you know, hasn't been totally faithful to him, and so... and then Don Pedro says something, I think, at the wedding about how like, what, you know, you don't want to give a sullied jewel to your friend. Like, why would you do that? You know, that's dishonorable. So I think that a lot of people are easily deceived when they, their chief, motivation is to protect that thing that is most valuable to them. And it's easy to see what you want to see when that's jeopardized or threatened or whatever. And I kind of was thinking about just kind of trying to remember when people drink in this version particularly, because they're always like going over to the, you know, the bar and getting another glass of wine. And I don't know, sometimes I wonder if they're drinking to kind of dull those things, you know, the pain of those things. They're kind of desensitizing themselves to seeing the truth of what's going on around them, or maybe even escaping responsibility of their own actions and what's taking place. But, I mean, not to comment on out like drinking and or alcoholism or anything like that, but just saying, you know, anyway, I don't know what I was saying. No. There you have it.
The end.
The end of my point.
No, those are all very good. Well, with that, I love this part because this is the part where typically, even if you've loved a movie, you can talk about that one thing that just did not make any sense to you. And this is difficult because it's Shakespeare. So I'm interested in hearing what your, come on, moments are. You draw straws again?
You must have something, Claire.
I'm the worst at come on moments. I go see movies to enjoy them. I don't really think about what I hate till way after. I guess I didn't get the sexy acrobats. I don't understand why. Their voice. In this story, we already touched on this song and how I wished it was a little bit more. The message of the song was pushed in a more heavy-handed manner a little bit, but I can't really think of anything.
Hang out with me longer; you'll learn to criticize.
Okay.
What was yours?
Mine. I would say that. Don John, especially in this version, is obviously, I'm trying to think of a non-explicit word to describe him.
He literally is a bastard.
Yes. So he is.
That is just a literal definition. Yeah, so is this the word you would like to use?
Yes. Well, I'll take it a step further. I'll say he is the bastard of bastards. And no one thinks to question this guy, you know? I mean, to a certain degree, they're kind of like, really? Don't, you know, don't say that, you know? They kind of, but, like, really, could this not be a scheme? Like, someone, he's, you know, and then he's almost, like, two-dimensional or one-dimensional as a villain. You know, I am a villain. Hello!
I am a plain-dealing villain, he says.
You know, yeah, so, and then, you know. Then he goes on to do something that was very villainesque, and I feel like someone should have known that, you know, he was kind of a villain. So I'm like, come on. But it's a comedy, so I kind of, you know, I let it slide because of the, you know, the play genre. But I was like, come on. And then the kind of the acrobats, I didn't really get it. I figured it was just because I'm not artistic enough.
That could also be it. I don't know.
I mean, I did lots of research. I should know why the acrobats were there.
I don't want to like start a whole other topic or whatever, but Don John was such a caricature, but it's great because everybody just messed up themselves. I mean, they didn't hardly even really need a push. They just, you know, they were bumbling around on their own. But I love that right after the fiasco of the wedding in Joss's version, Don John grabs a cupcake. Oh my gosh, that was so awesome.
Wait, we're not to our favorite part yet.
Oh.
We're still...
I thought we were done. Okay, my come on moment. I had a really hard time trying to think of these, but I think when Beatrice falls down the stairs, it's supposed to be really funny, but I was like, no, head trauma. That girl's not getting up from that fall. She falls, like, face first down the flight of stairs. But not only that, but, like, I like that scene when it is clear that it's clear to the people who are, you know, making up the story that, that Beatrice and Benedict are listening. They know Beatrice and Benedict are listening. But it doesn't make sense to me to stage it in a way where Beatrice or Benedict, like, aren't certain that they are being caught. Does that make sense? I mean, like, with Benedict, he was outside. He was doing, I mean, it is kind of, that moment is slapstick, is, you know, great for that kind of directing. But at least Benedict was outside, and so I could see that he would think, oh, they can't see me, you know? And, like, Beatrice does hide behind, like, a thing in the kitchen, but she's, like, walking across the kitchen in heels, and they're really not that far away from her. So I just kind of felt like she doesn't think that they see her. And the other thing was, I guess bad people just do this, but come on, Baraccio just walks in on Don John and what's her name having sex? It's like, I guess you guys just walk in on each other doing this kind of thing all the time. Because, you know, they weren't like, hey, get out. It was just like, hey, Baraccio.
That's what bad people do.
Apparently it is.
That's how we know they're bad.
Bad people watch each other have sex. That's how you know.
That's how you know.
Bad people don't knock.
That's right.
Exactly. The sign of the
bed. They need the little door handle.
Yeah, I was kind of like, really?
Okay, well, and then, so now we switch it up. Favorite moments.
I loved the picture of Hero watching her own memorial. I thought it was really evocative. And of course, the snorkel and the martini. That's going to live in film history. So there were some really nice pictures, I felt, in the film. I love slapstick, so I was pretty into the eavesdropping scene.
I did enjoy them as well.
I think I want to go back to Dogberry because I was just so shocked, like, how much I enjoyed. And just, I don't even know if I can explain why, but the fact that Nathan Fillion's tie was always messed up. I just love that. Because, like, to me, he's a big guy, and he's got, like, this, first of all, it's a teeny tie, like, clearly not for an adult man. And then it's always, like, mistied. It's, like, super short and mistied. And I just love that. I love about this interpretation, like, Joss's film, that he uses so many things to tell the story and to, I mean, there are just so many, like, extra things that make you feel the scene, and I don't know, I just felt like that was such a picture of just how earnest he was, but he was just getting it wrong, and there were so many things about Fillion's Dogberry that I really liked a lot.
Well, once again, someone's checking out my show notes, because that's basically, oh, that was my favorite part. Like, and I think it's because my expectation was probably really low. And it's not because I don't like Nathan Fillion. I really am a big Nathan Fillion fan. I think to be a Weed Knight, you kind of have to be a big Nathan Fillion fan. But the thing was, I was like, oh, man, they're just going to toss him in there, and we're going to be expected to love it because it's Nathan Fillion, mm-hmm. not because it's actually done really, really well. And from the moment that Nathan Fillion and Tom Link mm-hmm. Get their whole shtick going as Dogberry and Vargas. I mean, I was laughing or chuckling like the whole time. And in an NPR interview that Joss Whedon did, he was talking about how he felt like it was like romantic comedy meets cop show. And he just really saw, like, you know, he was laughing out loud the first time like he ever read it. And just imagine like Dogberry and Vargas just kind of having this like buddy cop, you know, kind of thing going on. And it totally did work. You know, he said, I thought I could make it work. And it totally worked with the, you know, every time you're going to say something important, you have to take the shades off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, them. It really did remind us that it was a comedy. Mm-hmm. When things, especially after the wedding, were really kind of uncomfortable and heavy. So I just, and Laura pointed this out earlier, that, you know, Nathan Fillion had admitted that he'd never actually done Shakespeare professionally. You know, he may have done it, like, you know, to the side and, or on the side and stuff like that. But for having ever done it professionally, watching him in that role was, I was impressed. I mean, there's lots of other things. I really did like the eavesdropping scenes as well, because, you know, as it was slapstick. It was hilarious, you know. So I did enjoy that as well. But, like I said, it seems like we all really enjoyed the film. And we would probably encourage everyone to go see it if you have a chance. If you haven't already, but then again, you probably shouldn't be listening to this if you haven't seen it already. Or you could, and realize that you've probably seen Much Ado in some form, sometime, or at least I hope you have. But, I do want to again thank my guests who have graciously broken the gender barrier to be here and make me not feel like a...
High five!
A sexist on my own podcast. So this is the point where you guys get to, like, let us know what you're up to. People who are out there just loving the things that you've had to say, they can interact with you, they can follow what you're doing, they can see where you get this inspiration and genius from. So how can we get a hold of you, Claire?
Well, I am on Facebook, I have a Twitter, and I also live on support. So we will include a link to more information on what I'm going to be doing in Asia. I'm moving in 2 weeks to Thailand, where I'm going to be taking training on how to use the arts in indigenous communities for cultural preservation, for education, for language preservation. So I'm really excited about that. It's with a faith-based nonprofit. You can find more information in the show notes.
Yes, and I do want to remind everyone, if there's anything that they mentioned, all their Twitter accounts, all their websites, and anything else that you we have kind of pulled from to make this episode, if you go to the website, which I'll tell you about later, that you will find them there. So, Laura?
Well, I am on Facebook, if you want to see all the Doctor Who themed things that I relink. I also have a Twitter, what is it called?
Just Twitter account?
Twitter account, mm-hmm. Yes. Laura_Fissel. And mostly I use that to kind of live, like give a live view of me when I'm writing, when I'm doing my job as writing. I am writing a book that I hope to have finished by October. And you can kind of follow that. Like I do post my progress in that editing and also sometimes give like little character spoilers and lines from the chapter I'm working on through Twitter, which also shows up on Facebook. So it's all connected. But sometimes I also blog about, what it's like to leave my teaching career behind and write full time and try to live as an artist. And my blog is leaving. teaching.blogspot.com, which is in the
channels. All right. I just think it's funny that the first two female guests we have both encourage people to friend them on Facebook. That's not sketchy at all.
You can friend us. We may not accept it, but...
It would be helpful to include a message that you listen to this podcast and you're friending me because you think I'm brilliantly witty and I don't mumble at all.
Oh, I just kind of... That was not an assumption with right. All friend requests.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, once again, thank you so much, for cutting, a little piece of your day, a slice of time to be here, especially Claire, since apparently we are not going to have a chance to talk to you unless we're doing it over Skype in 2 weeks. Depending on, I guess, the kind of, populous technology things that you have around you.
I'm hoping it can still Skype.
All right. Well, that'll be good. Well, for anyone else, we thank you for your time, for joining us today. And if you would like to get in touch with the show, ask questions, follow up, tell us where we just completely missed the point, please send us an email at podcast@realworldtheology.com. Go to the website, realworldtheology.com. That's where you can find this. You can find all the show notes on how to get in touch and follow the adventures of our two guests, and you can download the show there. You can get links to other posts and reviews that we do. As for Real World Theology, we also have another arm that does live events. Actually, this Friday, July 19th, we're going to be showing The Avengers and having a conversation after that. Also, this summer, we'll be looking at Shaun of the Dead and The Prestige. So if you're interested in any of those, go to the website. You can get all the information for that. And most importantly, you can subscribe to this podcast by going to iTunes, typing in Real World Theology, and hitting the subscribe button. If you do, if you like the show, leave us a review. I would appreciate it. So until next time, guys, continue watching movies that are great. Well, I guess watch movies that are bad, too, but just try to watch them with a different set of eyes. And remember, the entertainment is not mindless.